This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we analyze the significance of the potential win for the Labour Party in the UK.
The election's coming up on December 12th. If Jeremy Corbyn and the Social Democratic Labour Party win there, it's an event of historic proportions.
The recent released Hollywood film Harriet is the first feature movie focusing on the legendary Underground Railroad leader.
She escaped from slavery in Maryland, went back six times to get her family and other people out of there, and eventually during the Civil War led hundreds of black soldiers on a raid in Alabama. It's quite a story.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
Next month, on December 12th, Great Britain will hold national elections. Jeremy Corbyn heads the Labour Party there. He's a social democrat, similar in some respects to Bernie Sanders and what he stands for. Corbyn has said, "I'll be a very different kind of prime minister, not the kind of prime minister who believes he was born to rule." Working people in Great Britain are struggling like they are in the USA. The Labour Party has addressed what to do about their situation. It has grown qualitatively in recent years and has a chance of winning the election. What the Labour Party stands for and what their leader, Jeremy Corbyn, has done to prepare for taking power is what we will be discussing today with our guest, Colin Robinson. Robinson is a longtime member of the Labour Party. Originally from Liverpool, he was educated in London, where he was an active socialist. He moved to New York 30 years ago to work as a publisher. He splits his time between New York City and London. Robinson has written for The Guardian newspaper and the London Review of Books. He's the co-owner of Orr Books, with offices in New York, London, and Calcutta. Colin Robinson, it's good to see you again. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Very pleased to be here, Michael.
Colin, you're a longtime member of the Labour Party. How is it different from the American Democratic Party?
Well, the Labour Party came out of the workers' movement in Britain. It was formed in 1900 as a political representation for the trade unions. So at its very heart, it's connected with the British working class. It's often betrayed their interests subsequently, but that's how it started. And it's a membership organization. It has a large membership now. Just recently, since Jeremy Corbyn became leader in 2016, its membership has increased to over 500,000, making it the largest political party in Europe. And it has still the semblance of democratic structures, even though those were very badly weakened by the Blair leadership.
You mean they actually have meetings and decide policy and pay dues?
Right. If you're a member of the Labour Party, you're in a thing called a ward, which is your local organization. And they send representatives from the ward meetings to constituency meetings. And constituency meetings send people to the conference. And the conference discusses the party policy. It's not binding on the leadership, but it is indicative of what the membership's thinking. Also, you have a big role in electing the leader. Since 2015... the Labour Party has operated a system for electing the leader of one member, one vote. So the MPs get a single vote. The members of trade unions who are affiliated to the party get a single vote each. And the membership gets a single vote. And so you get to vote on who the leader of the party is directly in that way. So it's a much more democratic party than the party that... it's called the Democratic Party, and it's much more closely tied in with the working class.
The Labour Party has grown enormously, as you've pointed out, in the last few years, and it has a huge infusion of young people. Talk about how that came about, please.
Well, it really resulted from Jeremy Corbyn's election to the leadership, 2016. they changed the rules for electing the leader in the party. Prior to that, the rules had been an electoral college where MPs, trade unions, and members got a third of the vote each. Well, as there were hundreds of thousands of members and only a few hundred MPs, that meant that the MPs had a much bigger vote per person than the membership. But in order to get rid of the influence of the trade unions, which is what they were really trying to do, the right in the party supported an arrangement where the unions would give up their share of the block vote in this system that they had, and in exchange the right offered the possibility of the MPs giving up their share of the block vote. And quite cleverly, Len McCluskey, who's the leader of the largest trade union in Britain, Unite, and a close ally of Corbyn, accepted this proposal, even though it meant that his members, the leadership of the unions, was losing some influence. It meant that the MPs, who were generally on the right of the party, lost more influence. So they moved to a system of one member, one vote, and to the astonishment of everyone, on the basis of that new system being introduced, certainly to the astonishment of the right, but actually the left was surprised by this, everyone was, Jeremy Corbyn came through and won a stunning victory to become leader of the party. And that really meant that for the first time, really in the history of the party, its leadership was held by someone who was very much from the left. I mean, Corbyn is a real campaigning socialist, a social democrat, but very much from the left. And that energized a base of young people across the country who'd been fed up with the centrist policies of the Blair and Brown governments, and certainly appalled by the Tory governments that we'd had, who were very much opposed to the Iraq War, and were concerned about things like climate change, to join the party as something that they thought could represent their views. And so there was a huge influx of membership. That stands the party very well in the face of the general election, which is coming up.
Well, let's talk about what the Labour Party stands for, particularly on the central issue of our time, climate change, but also employment, private ownership of industry, healthcare, housing, education, the rights of Palestinians, the wars in the Middle East. Let's take them one by one. Let's first talk about climate change. What does the Labour Party want to do about impeding climate catastrophe?
Well, there are floods occurring in Yorkshire at the moment in Britain that have devastated a lot of communities there. In the north of England, the effect of climate change seems to be extremely heavy and intense rainfall. So the rivers have swollen and people's houses are flooded, and the Tory government was extremely slow to react to this. Corbyn called for Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, to go into to set up a meeting with an organisation called COBRA, which is supposed to deal with disaster relief. Johnson initially declined to do this, but then in the end had to give way, and they have had COBRA meetings now in the north of England with Johnson in attendance. But I think Labour have got a much stronger position on climate change than the Conservatives, not least because the Conservatives are pretty closely tied to Donald Trump. So Labour is calling for what they call a green industrial revolution. It's a bit similar to the Green New Deal in the United States. What it involves is massive investment in wind and wave power and in solar panels, and in creating good, well-paid, unionized jobs in order to build the infrastructure that makes that possible. And they're committing very significant sums of money to that.
Would they shy away from taking over recalcitrant industries in Great Britain that don't want to go along with this?
Well, they're certainly... there are proposals to take over the utility companies, certainly the water companies which put up the cost of water in Britain enormously, and are also, from an environmental point of view, extremely wasteful because they haven't repaired the infrastructure, so a lot of water is wasted. So there are proposals to nationalise water, to take stakes in the other utility companies. They also want to renationalise the railways, and invest a lot of money in the railways, especially in the north, as an alternative to cars. And they want to nationalise the post office. I think when you use the word nationalise, though, these days, you have to be a bit careful, because this is not really like the nationalisation that occurred back in the 40s and then got a sort of bad reputation in the 70s for being very bureaucratic, kind of top-down management that was out of touch with the consumers. The sort of nationalisation that they're proposing now, sort of public ownership they're proposing, is much more democratically based than that. This is ownership that would be run by the workers who work in the industry at quite low levels, and also by the people who use these services. They would have an input too, so it would be much more sensitive to the needs of the people who are using these industries and working in them.
We're speaking with Colin Robinson, a longtime member of the Labour Party in Great Britain, who splits his time between New York City and London, and knows quite a lot about the Labour Party, as I'm learning. Colin, what about the Labour Party's positions on health care, housing, education?
Well, we're faced with a situation which is really quite dangerous for something which is most treasured in Britain by a vast majority of the population. I mean, I don't know if people would have seen Danny Boyle's opening ceremony for the Olympic Games that were held in Britain a few years ago, but one of the things that featured in that celebration was a reenactment of the glory of the National Health Service. And it's a system which provides healthcare for everyone, free at the point of delivery. It's extremely efficient. It really was set up in 1945 by a Labour government at the end of the war. And it's a national treasure. You know, it's something that has huge public support, to the extent that the Tories have never been able to openly attack it. But they have been attacking it by stealth. So increasingly there is, within this publicly owned service, privatisation. A little bit here, a little bit there. There are private patients in NHS hospitals. There are services that are being provided by the NHS, which they are contracting from private suppliers. So this has been going on for years, both under the Blair government and under the Tory government under David Cameron. But suddenly there's a much bigger risk to this now, because it's very clear that if the Tories are elected in this election on December 12th with a majority, then they are going to go into a alliance with Donald Trump to allow these big American health companies to come into the NHS and accelerate this privatization in a really dramatic way. And this is a real danger to the NHS. So Labour have said they will absolutely resist any attempts to do that. They will roll back the privatization, which has already occurred. And they're also promising to make a big financial investment in the NHS.
In the United States, the lack of housing, the cost of housing, has put hundreds of thousands of people into the streets and into camps. What is the Labour Party position on the lack of decent housing in Great Britain?
Well, I mean, it's a crisis in Britain too. The homelessness figures have shot up because of the inflation of property prices, and also the huge slump in social housing that occurred after Margaret Thatcher decided she was going to sell off a huge number of, in Britain they're called council houses. These were built by local authorities for people on low incomes, often for rent. actually for, always for rent. Thatcher had the bright idea of selling these off. It was a way of reinforcing her notion of a property-owning democracy. So all that stock of previously available, affordable housing for rent disappeared. And homelessness is absolutely endemic now in major British cities. And Corbyn's been very... sometimes he sounds a bit like a Christian socialist. You know, he's very good on delivering these simple moral messages. And one of the things which he has repeatedly made a point of saying is that it is absolutely unacceptable in one of the richest countries in the world, Britain, today, that people, so many people, should be sleeping on the streets. And I think this is actually something that's connected with young people in a very effective way. So Labour have got a pledge, or at least they did in the 2017 election, to build 100,000 affordable houses a year for rent. The 2019 manifesto hasn't been announced yet, but I'm sure the commitment then will be something along those lines.
In the United States, there's a crisis in higher education. The cost of college is really prohibitive, and students are going into debt well over their heads. Is the same situation prevail in Great Britain? And what does the Labour Party want to do about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I went to college back in the 70s, there was no tuition. I mean, it was just paid for by the state. And also, when you were given a grant to help with your accommodation, when the university vacations came around, you could just sign on at the unemployment benefit and get your rent paid that way, as well as claiming benefits. So the situation now has completely changed from that. I mean, there's enormous student fees, and Labour have made a commitment that they will just abolish them. They're going to make higher education free. And they're also going to make it possible, this was a statement they made yesterday, for people to go back into education at any time in their lives. Because I think Corbyn's understanding is that this is not just a way of growing the economy, but also a way of actually providing an enjoyable life for people, to give them the opportunity to learn when they want to.
Julian Assange, the great truth-telling whistleblower, is sitting, as we talk, in Belmarsh prison in solitary confinement, awaiting his extradition to the United States, where the Trump administration wants to put him in prison for the rest of his life. What has Jeremy Corbyn said about the Assange situation?
Both he and the Shadow Home Secretary have Diane Abbott, have said that they would not extradite Assange to the US. They would have appreciated, I think, in particular, the release of the Iraq war logs that WikiLeaks was responsible for. This was the material that Chelsea Manning gave to WikiLeaks, which they published in the face of no one else wanting to do so, including that extraordinarily painful to watch video called, which WikiLeaks called Collateral Murder, which showed a helicopter in Baghdad gunning down innocent people, including Reuters journalists, and was a material factor in undermining the American and British war effort in Iraq. Jeremy Corbyn and Diane Abbott were opposed to that war from the get-go, in a very small minority of British MPs who did so. But I think one of the reasons why they're so popular with young people in Britain is because they are clearly against these hopeless wars that American Britain have been involved in.
By extension, in support of Palestinian rights in the Middle East.
Absolutely. Corbyn's had a long tradition of supporting the Palestinians. And, of course, that's got him into a lot of difficulty with people who support the State of Israel.
I was going to ask you about that, because they're saying that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite.
Yeah, there's been a weaponization of anti-Semitism, which has been extremely unfortunate and is still going on through this election campaign going up to December 12th. There have been some issues of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I suspect that they're much less widespread inside the Labour Party, which is basically an anti-racist party, than they are in society as a whole. And actually, I don't think that anti-Semitism until recently, and even recently, has been a big issue in British society. I mean, there is certainly anti-Semitism around in the world today, and wherever it is, it should be combated, but it hasn't been a big issue in British society, and it certainly hasn't been a big issue in the Labour Party. But this has been used as a way of attacking the Labour leadership, and I don't think that they've dealt with it very well. I think they've rather been on the back foot. They've been very defensive about it, but it's a very difficult thing to deal with, where the Jewish establishment and the British press and the right-wing leadership of the Tory party have all been using this as a way of undermining the leadership of the Labour Party. It's very, very difficult to deal with. Whether this is a big issue for wide swathes of the electorate around the country, I think you'd have to be a bit more sceptical about that. But it's certainly going to be a factor in this election.
The heartland in the USA has been deindustrialized, with millions losing their jobs. And something similar to this has happened in Great Britain. The Brexit vote to pull England out of the European Union has divided the working class in Great Britain. I wanted to ask you about your opinion of Brexit. Has there been an adequate discussion about why people would want to leave in the first place?
No, I don't think so. I think what happened was that vote which took place under the Cameron government, it was a referendum which was basically instituted in 2015 in order to try to deal with a split in the Tory party. And the result of it was really a shock to the establishment, a bit like the election of Trump here. No one really anticipated that this would go through. But it did, and I think subsequent attempts to explain it, often made by rather right-wing commentators in the metropolitan elite of London, were very disparaging of people. Brexit vote was split between the Tories in the home counties around London and wide sections of working-class people in the north and the West Midlands of England. And people in the London media and the political elite have very little idea of what those people in the north of England and the West Midlands actually thought about anything. I mean, they very rarely go up there. So as soon as this vote came through, the tendency was to ascribe it to a kind of xenophobia, racism, ignorance, the feeling that these people really didn't know what was best for them. But I think if you talk to people who do know what is going on in those communities in the north, they'd say, actually, this was much more to do with a factor of basically saying, we're fed up with this. We're fed up with the way that the establishment has been running this country for so long. We're fed up with the fact that our communities are being ravaged by, they wouldn't call it neoliberalism, but by international capitalism. And we want to just basically have no more of this. And so it was a way of sticking a finger up at this establishment. But I have a lot of sympathy for that. As I think does Jeremy Corbyn. I think he's been quite careful, even though the majority of the Labour membership, a substantial majority of the Labour membership, is pro-Remain. Corbyn's been very careful not to alienate that Labour base in the north that voted for Brexit as a way of expressing their frustration. And the position of the party is that should they win on December 12th, they will organise another referendum, and they will then go to Europe and try and negotiate a much better deal than Boris Johnson's negotiated, and then put that better deal to the electorate with the option of remaining. and allow people to have a final say. I mean, it's a complicated position to explain on the doorstep, and it has the disadvantage of keeping this debate around Brexit rolling on, although it's going to roll on anyway, even if the Tories win and Britain comes out of the European Union straight away. But it's a way of recognising that in the end, you have to try and bring the country back together again around this issue. And I think Corbyn's been very good at saying that actually this isn't the most important issue facing Britain, that actually the most important issues facing Britain are inequality and racism and climate change and issues like that. And so I really hope that Labour's going to be able to get that position over in this campaign. I think that's what they're working on.
Well, as it stands now, what do you think the Labour Party's chances are of success?
Well, you know, I mean, I wouldn't be a socialist if I wasn't a bit of an optimist. I mean, it's hard to be a pessimistic socialist. So I think we're in with a chance. I mean, there are lots of things ranged against Labour. I mean, there is an extraordinarily hostile media. But a couple of things that are worth noting on the media front. First is that actually the rules of British elections are so much better than the rules in American elections. First of all, it's a much shorter campaign period, so you can people can focus on the campaign. I mean, basically, there's always an election.
Yeah, really, it's a month and a half rather than a year and a half.
Right. There's always an election running in the United States, and it's always the most important election of our lifetimes. But in Britain, it's in a much more concentrated period. In that period, the political parties are not allowed to buy advertising on television. That's banned. So that makes a huge difference. Parties are allocated time on television to put their case based on how they performed in the previous election. So they get things, they call them party political broadcasts, which are time which the broadcasters have to give over to the political parties based on how popular they are to address the public. And then in the news coverage in the election period, there is a legal requirement on the broadcasters to give equal space to the political parties based on how they performed in previous elections. So that gives Labour a much better shot than when the coverage is just normal, when obviously the broadcasters, like the rest of the media, and certainly like the newspapers, are, you know, generally ranged against them. Another thing which is quite significant, I think, in this election, and is kind of a bit of a straw in the wind, is that The Guardian, which is the kind of main left liberal, I perhaps put that the other way around, liberal left paper in the UK, which has traditionally ignored the readership that it has, which is solidly on the left and gone for a much more centrist politics, has already come out pretty clearly actually and said that it is going to be supporting Corbyn in this election. And that's a shift on their part. So I think those things are actually quite positive. But the Tories have got a lot of money. They've got a lot of business backing, obviously. And they've also got a propensity to lie, you know, without qualms. You know, the truth is really not a principal question for them. That gives them some advantage. They can just put things out there that are not true, and they go around and, you know, some people believe them. So it's not going to be easy. But, yeah, I think we're in with a chance. We've got 500,000 members. They're going out, they're knocking on people's doors. I mean, I heard the other day there's a constituency called Chingford near London, and it's a seat occupied by a Tory called Ian Duncan Smith. He's one of the most right-wing, racist, a really, really unpleasant politician, quite high up in the Tory party. And last weekend, Momentum, which is the activist organization supporting Jeremy Corbyn at the base of the Labour Party, sent 500 young people there over the weekend, 500, to go and knock on doors. And the reports coming back from that were that they were getting a very good response. So I think Labour are talking about this as a people-powered election. And I think, you know, that'll go a long way.
It's amazing to me how what you're saying about what's going on in Great Britain resonates with what's going on here in the United States and the Bernie Sanders phenomena and all the and the local phenomenons too, like Chesa Boudin winning as a progressive for district attorney in San Francisco. But Colin, before we move on, there's one question that I just can't resist asking you. You're from Liverpool. Was John Lennon a socialist?
Yeah, I think he was. Yeah, he definitely was. He was certainly anti-establishment. I don't know whether he ever actually came out and supported Labour in those days. I mean, there was a Labour government around in the 60s under Harold Wilson, but it was pretty centrist, you know, moderate Labour government. I think John had a more radical position than that. He went on the anti-war demonstrations against the Vietnam War. I know he marched with Tariq Ali, and I think he and Yoko wrote that song, Give Peace a Chance, as a way of protesting war. So I don't know whether he was actually a Labour Party supporter, but he was certainly on the left. Well, and Jürgen, let me just say that Jürgen Klopp, who is the manager of the Liverpool soccer team, there's a statement by him going around at the moment. I think it may be something he said some years ago, but anyway, it's going around at the moment. Liverpool traditionally been one of the strongest soccer teams in the world. I mean, they've had a bit of a tough time over the last few decades, but in the 70s and 80s, they were the greatest football team in the world. And I'm a big Liverpool supporter. You know, they play in red. So, you know, I know red and blue means different things in the United States, but in most of the rest of the world, red is identified with the left. Their original manager, Bill Shankly, the one who first made them successful, was a socialist and said that he thought that the way they should play soccer was as socialists, you know, that it was a team game and that everyone was equal and that you had to learn to pass the ball. He also said some people said soccer was a matter of life and death, but it was much more important than that. Anyway, Jürgen Klopp's now come out and said that he's also on the left and the current Liverpool manager. So that's something that it's great for Liverpool, which is a big left-wing city.
Absolutely. Colin Robinson, we're running out of our allotted time. Before I let you go, you're the publisher, along with John Oakes, at Orr Books, and you've got a new book out about Julian Assange, in defense of Julian Assange. You published recently a book about the Labour Party, and I would like you to please just give us the titles of the books, tell us how people can get them, and how they can be in touch with Orr, what you're trying to do with Orr Books.
The book on Assange that we're publishing, we've got a party coming up to launch it in New York next week. It's called In Defense of Julian Assange, and it's edited by Tariq Ali, who is a writer and activist in London, and Margaret Kunstler, who's a lawyer in New York. And it's got a huge list of prominent people arguing from different angles in mainly original pieces as to why Assange has to be defended. You know, he's a very polarizing character, but I think increasingly people are realizing that what the Trump administration is trying to do to him is a major threat to press freedom. You know, he's facing 175 years in a supermax for basically being a publisher. And I think from, you know, attorneys at the New York Times to the Washington Post, right across the board, actually, people are beginning to realize that if this is allowed to happen to Julian Assange, then publishers everywhere are at risk. So I think this is quite an important book. And we've also got a book coming out called People Get Ready, which is a book setting out what we need to be talking about if there's going to be a Labour government in Britain. Because in a way, although it's going to be an enormous struggle to get a Labour government, that's going to be nothing as to what's going to be involved if it succeeds. The whole British establishment is going to be up in arms. And how you deal with a civil service where the highest levels of the civil service are basically hostile to your programme, where the Bank of England is an enormous player in the financial system, obviously, is completely dominated at its higher levels by Tories. These are really big questions. So this book attempts to address those and open up a discussion on the left about how we might handle them.
Well, Colin Robinson, it's been a real pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. We hope that our dreams come true with Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party. It would really change world history. We should pay attention to this because the parallels with what's going on in the United States are direct and obvious, and we can learn something from this. So we thank you very much for coming down to our studio here in New York and being our guest on Law and Disorder. And good luck, and you take it easy.
Thanks very much, Michael.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In the recently released film Harriet, an active and young gun-toting Harriet Tubman jumps off bridges and faces down slave owners. Directed by Cossie Lemons, who calls Tubman a completely badass woman, the new film shows sides of the legendary Tubman that contrast with how we remember her. This is the first feature film focusing on the legendary Underground Railroad leader. The filmmakers made an effort to ensure accuracy, given that many myths about Tubman have circulated over the years. The first biography about her, Scenes in the Life of Harriet Tubman by Sarah Hopkins Bradford, included many inaccuracies, such as the number and nature of her rescues. That set the stage for more inaccurate accounts to come. Joining us today to talk about Harriet Tubman and the issue of enslaved women is Professor Jessica Millward. She's an associate professor in the Department of History at the University of California, Irvine. Her research focuses on slavery in early America, African American history, as well as women and gender. Her first book, Finding Charity's Folk, Enslaved and Free Black Women in Maryland, was published in 2015 by the University of Georgia Press. Professor Millward, welcome to Law and Disorder. Professor Millward, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
As the author of a book on enslaved women, what does Harriet Tubman stand for in your mind?
I think Harriet Tubman stands for this aspect of African-American history that people often don't know, and that's that African-Americans were actively engaged in trying to free themselves, either by running away or petitioning for their freedom, or negotiating or buying their freedom. Harriet Tubman represents this aspect of African-American people fighting for their own freedom.
In your book, Finding Charity's Folk, Enslaved and Free Black Women in Maryland, you cite the importance of honoring and remembering enslaved women by telling their stories and by speaking their names. Do you think the movie accomplished that?
I think it did to an extent. It brought Harriet Tubman, the full spectrum of her life, into the American public. In some ways, having a major motion picture that focuses on her makes it impossible to escape Harriet Tubman in the public lexicon. So I do think it did that kind of work, that kind of redemptive work.
Yeah, I thought what you said a moment ago was so striking in the movie, when you have at the end of the movie Harriet, who's really come into her own as a fighter and a leader, leading hundreds of black soldiers down to Alabama on a raid against the enslavers. It was really quite a dramatic moment in the movie.
It was a dramatic moment, and the beautiful thing about that, Michael, is that is true. That is not made up. It's not fictitious like Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained. This is an actual story, an actual moment that happened. I think it's incredible. I got a little teary-eyed, even though I know how the movie ends, even though I know that there's some controversy. I did get a little choked up at that scene.
Yeah, me too. You know, I don't think that people realized, I didn't realize, you know, Harriet came from Maryland, and she actually lived only 100 miles from Pennsylvania, which was a free state, and she escaped to Pennsylvania, and she came back six or seven times to help other people, particularly her family, get out of Maryland into freedom in Pennsylvania. And I was wondering, could you tell us, slavery started in Maryland?
Yes, it did. So slavery started in Maryland almost at its inception. Maryland, like Virginia, passed laws very early on that indicated that the status of the child would follow that of the mother. Virginia passed that law in 1662. By 1664, Maryland was even stricter. They passed a law saying any person of African descent or any person that had a black parent would actually be enslaved. So even though slavery was kind of hand-in-hand in Maryland, the other thing that people don't realize is there was also a burgeoning free black population that comes about by the time we get to the 19th century.
Including her husband, Harriet's husband, was a free black.
Including, exactly. Maryland is this place where the production of tobacco requires year-round laborers, but Maryland switches to producing wheat that doesn't require enslaved people year-round. So many slave owners would either liquidate their quote-unquote human property, or they would hire them out. And in the middle of all this, black people then are able to earn an actual wage in some cases and buy their own freedom. And so you have this population of free and enslaved people mixing all the time. So even though Harriet was only 100 miles away from freedom, she actually is experiencing freedom in the lives of people she knows.
Tell us who Charity Foulkes is and how you became interested in her.
So Charity Foulkes was an enslaved black woman. She was enslaved in Maryland, Annapolis, Maryland. She was born in about 1757, so she lived through the American Revolution. And after the American Revolution, people like Charity Foulkes were being freed at a pretty large rate, as I discussed, because Maryland makes this shift between tobacco and into wheat. Charity actually earns her freedom by caring for her owner's sick nephew, and there's this story that the owner bestows freedom onto Charity Foulkes out of this great act of gratitude and benevolence. I actually argue that Charity and her husband were trying to buy their freedom for quite some time. The point being said is that Charity Foulkes not only was able to secure her freedom, but she actually secured the freedom of her children and her grandchildren. In the course of 30 years, her entire family was actually free. So freedom isn't immediate. Freedom takes a while, but Charity Foulkes was able to secure the freedom of successive generations. And how did I meet her? I met Charity Foulkes through two documents. There was exactly two paragraphs written about her, and I met her through a freedom document that actually gave freedom to her, her children, and her grandchildren. And so I, like the good historian, I followed the paper trail that for a long time didn't exist. I scoured every archive. I could not find anything more about Charity Foulkes. And then, as luck would have it, I decided to step outside the archive, something historians don't do, and I decided to ask local genealogists what they knew about Charity Foulkes. Come to find out, I had a lot of the documents the entire time. I just did not know how the story fit together. It was detective work.
Academic detective work. When you say you had some of the story in front of you, do you mean there were references to her without her name in it?
What I mean is because slavery discombobulated, dislocated I don't want to say destroyed families, because I'm actually on the side of scholars who think that despite it all, African Americans kept strong family ties. But you have multiple people with different last names, if they have a last name at all. So, for example, Charity Folks had two children with the last name of Jackson. She had three children with the last name of Folks. Then she had other free black family members that married into the family. So I had a freedom document for her. I had another document with her son-in-law, William Bishop, his freedom certificate, but I didn't realize that they actually were related. So I had basically records of the free black community in Annapolis. I just did not know how it fit together for a very long time.
You know, we think of freedom in the context of Harriet Tubman as an individual act, but you write that it was really a communal act. How so?
Well, I believe that, and maybe this is my romantic view, that some people are always concerned about the community, but what the evidence shows, just like Harriet Tubman went back and forth to free her family, the evidence shows that African Americans were very engaged in trying to buy their family members out of slavery, or they were engaged in running away together. I think that as Americans, in particular, there's this notion of the rugged individualist who, follows this capitalist system, and it's like survival of the fittest. Enslaved people really felt that this was a communal endeavor. If someone ran away and they were caught, they were brought back and punished in front of the community so that slaveholders could instill fear in everyone else who wanted to run away. If people did run away and they stayed away, they become a little bit of a local hero. Enslaved people also told stories to one another that traveled through what we call the grapevine. And they knew of people who resisted slaveholding in any way they could. So I do think that it was a communal effort and was celebrated and equally feared if someone did run away. You know, Harriet's husband, this is what the movie gets wrong. The movie actually has Harriet's husband waiting for her, and she chose not to tell him she was running away because she didn't want him to be put in any kind of compromised position if they were caught. He actually never wanted to run away with Harriet. He felt that they might not be successful. He worried about the repercussions it would bring to her family if they ran away. He worried about them getting caught. And most importantly, he worried about if they were caught, would he be returned back into enslavement? So he actually never wanted to run away and risk it.
Yeah, the movie brings that out. And then, of course, they wanted to have a child, and they got a legal opinion from a lawyer saying if they had a child, the child would be free. They took the legal letter to this really vicious slave master owner, and he read the letter and then tore it up. And that was what, in the movie anyway, it's shown to be the triggering force that got Harriet to split. And she runs away. She gets trapped. The bad guys have her on a bridge, and they're on either side of the bridge. She jumps into the river. Is there truth to that escape?
I actually have not found evidence of that. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. In the accounts that I've seen, Harriet is very clandestine about how she actually made it to freedom. You have to remember at the time that Harriet Tubman escapes, and then she goes back. She then becomes an abolitionist, right? And she's on the speaker circuit with people like Frederick Douglass. And she's very secretive about how she actually finally made it north, especially as she's speaking and slavery is still in full effect, right? Because you don't want to give away the freedom route. So I have actually never heard that account, but, you know, it worked for the movie. And they had to do something. They had to do something dramatic. It's a Hollywood film.
Since we are a legal show, can you talk about what types of evidence slaves were able to muster to prevail in freedom lawsuits?
So this is what is crazy. Here is a population that's not, they legally are not supposed to read and write. They could find themselves in a lot of trouble if it was, you know, discovered that they could read or write, but they listened, right? They listened. So in the case of Charity Folks, she lived in the house where her owner was actually a well-known lawyer. so they could absorb legal customs, and they hear things. You know, they might look like they're not paying attention, but they hear things. In order to mount a case, this is rough statistics, right? This is Jessica Millward's version of statistics. In 9 out of 10 cases, they often needed an abolitionist lawyer, someone who was sentimental and loyal to the cause. And many abolitionist societies actually paid for the legal fees for enslaved people to bring petition suits. Now, in the case of Harriet and people like her, in 1808, Maryland passed a law, the state of Maryland passed a law saying that any child born to an enslaved woman, the status of that child had to be determined at the time of the child's birth. And what this means is slave owners are very invested in keeping generations of enslaved people as their property, right? But because of the way that laws were shifting, specifically with the end of the international slave trade in 1808, there had to be a way to ensure that there would be generations of people enslaved. So if the slaveholder, for example, I mean, let's think about this logically. Who, at the time of a slave being born, would go to court and say, and now all these future generations are going to be enslaved or freed? All this means is there was a loophole. There was a loophole that if people had heard or they were told, for example, that they would be freed at a certain date, it's called gradual manumission, or their children would be freed, some of them had the resources to get the aid of local abolitionist societies, or they knew people who actually knew how to read, they knew where the copy of the legal document was stored, and they would find access to this legal document and present it in court. And you would be amazed how many documents in last wills and testaments, in manumission records, you will see that actually slaveholders do delineate at the time Dinah reaches age 21, she will be freed, or at the time, you know, John reaches 35, he will be freed. Enslaved people normally had more success bringing freedom suits if they were, one, they could prove that they were born of a free woman, similar to Brazil. Brazil had free womb laws. Or two, if they could in some ways prove that they've been buying their freedom. And three, what's very interesting, people who were actually freed by their owner were often freed after they were no longer economically profitable to the owner. So women were freed after their childbearing years, which was typically after 21, right? In the 21st century, we think about 21 as being actually too young to even start a family, where enslaved women were almost past the prime reproductive capacity. And then enslaved men were often freed after the age of 35, when they were physically a bit weaker and couldn't produce as much for the slaveholder. So that's a long answer, but since it's a legal show, I mean, it's still shorter than a legal brief.
That was an excellent answer. Thank you. We're speaking with Professor Jessica Millward at the University of California. Jessica, this figure astounded me when I heard it, and I'm going to ask you we can educate our audience. How much was a slave worth?
Oh, well, I'm so glad you asked that question. We used to think it was, you know, $200 or $300, and that was still a lot for those times. But I believe in the movie, the slave mistress talks about, you're going to have to refresh my memory, but she gives the figure of about $800 or $900. She put a price. And that's pretty consistent. For those that want to read more, particularly about slave pricing, I highly recommend the book by Dinah Rainey Berry, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh. And I know we're supposed to be talking about my book, but I will just say that this book talks about the price of enslaved people from birth to actually death and beyond their life in the grave, because people don't realize that enslaved people, their bodies were actually sold to medical schools for experimentation. So that entire book gives much more background to the price of enslaved people than I could ever do.
Can you talk for a minute about the burdens that enslaved women faced that men did not?
the first burden that they faced, right, is the fact that they were female in a very violent society, where as soon as they first menstruated, enslavers assumed they were women, and it was not unheard of for a young slaveholder or the son of the plantation to go to the slave cabins and he and his friend break the young girl in, right? In the slave community, it was often told that young girls should not talk about when they first bleed, because that would signal to them it wasn't perverse to then go and rape your own property. And sometimes young girls were bleeding at the age of, you know, 7, 8, and 9. Sally Hemings was 13 years old when Thomas Jefferson took her to France, and sexual relations ensued. And people like to say that that was a consensual relationship. I mean, I've never subscribed to that. So the first is sexual violence. There were enslaved men and boys who were also victimized, but not at the rate of enslaved women. The other issue is because the status of the children followed that of the mother. Slave women were most likely to stay with the child. If they're freed, they're often freed with their child, so they go into freedom with the responsibility of having to care for their child. And the other issue is that they, enslaved women, sometimes were in closer contact with the slave mistress. So if they, for example, were victimized by the slaveholder, the master, they're also in constant contact, and we see this in the Harriet film, they're in constant contact with the slave mistress she can't exact her revenge on her husband, so she exacts it by punishing enslaved women.
Yeah, there was that really vitriolic speech by the slave owner's wife, who hated Harriet Tubman and wanted to see her caught and tortured and killed.
Absolutely, because it's easier to punish the enslaved person than it is to, you know, fight back fight back and stand up to your husband. Remember, this is also 19th century law, where women are still under the coverture of men, right? There's still a patriarchal system where one doesn't speak back to their husband, and they certainly didn't have any legal rights, so it's easier to punish the enslaved property.
Professor, it's really been a pleasure to meet you and to talk to you about a bit of the history of women enslaved.
The book that Jessica Millward wrote is called Finding Charity's Folk, Enslaved and Free Black Women in Maryland. We recommend the book. We're grateful for having you on Law and Disorder, Jessica. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.